Well, welcome to another edition of the Tottenham Way podcast. I am Marcus Buckland, joined once more by Dan Kilpatrick of the Evening Standard and Tom Barkley of The Sun. Tom Allnutt of The Times is busy unearthing stories elsewhere this week. At least that's what he's told us. I think he's lying on a beach somewhere. But by Spurs standards, it has anyway been a relatively quiet few days in between two important home games against Brighton and Bournemouth, which gives us an opportunity to assess the state of the squad as we head towards the end of the season. Who should stay? Who should go? The possible implications if Tottenham don't finish in the top four. And we'll have a brief look at the remaining fixtures. There was also an appointment behind the scenes last week with Scott Munn brought in effectively as Daniel Levy's deputy. Just before we focus on those topics, a brief word about last weekend's extraordinary game against Brighton. I had two close friends who are Brighton fans, and they are still moaning and complaining. I have no idea why. Okay, they should have had two penalties. They should have had two goals, maybe a red card for a Spurs player. But get on with it. You failed against Son and Kane. It's your own fault if you can't defend against those titans of the game. But what an important, if fortuitous, 3 points those were for Spurs. I wonder also, Dan and Tom, how potentially significant that afternoon might be in terms of perhaps Roberto De Zerbi becoming, or now not ever, becoming Tottenham's manager. He had an interesting afternoon, Dan, to say the least, didn't he?
Yeah, it was a mixed audition for De Zerbi, definitely. I mean, his side came to Spurs, played them off the park, really, and were very, very unlucky. And we now kind of know that they were robbed by the officials, because the officials have come out and apologised to Brighton and said they should have had a penalty, and that wasn't the only contentious decision. But I thought De Zerbi came with quite a strange energy. He tried to impose himself on the occasion and directly on Christian Cellini, even before a ball was kicked. You know, before the match started at the handshake, Cellini went over and De Zerbi was kind of in his face pointing and very animated and clearly very angry. And he refused to say afterwards what that was about. The most likely logical explanation is that he misconstrued some of what Cellini said, which was very mild and complimentary at his pre-match press conference. And I wasn't that impressed with it, to be honest. He would never have done that to Conte. Never in a million years would he have behaved like that to Conte, or even any permanent Spurs manager, I think. I think he was trying to take advantage of the fact that Cellini was still new and in this quite uncertain position. And I didn't think he came across that well. In fact, I think he came across as the disrespectful one in the end, and then kind of wound himself up, got sent off in the second half. And that was a bit of a turning point, lifted the crowd. Obviously, Cellini went as well, but he was a bit unlucky. And Spurs kind of kicked on from there. So a mixed audition for De Zerbi. His side played great football. It would be great if Spurs played like that, obviously. And I still think it'd be a very exciting and interesting appointment. But I don't think, you know, he'll have particularly impressed Daniel Levy, who probably will have had his fill of Italian firebrands who caused trouble on the touchline by now.
I also love, Tom, that the look of bewilderment on the face of Cellini when he was sent off. And I know why he was, because there is the rule that you've got to keep control of your bench. And obviously the bench was out of control. It was an astonishing few minutes down by the dugouts, wasn't it?
It certainly was. And I did really feel for him, both before the game and at that point. De Zerbi was trying to say afterwards that particularly that moment, which ended up with them having red cards and the sort of melee between the two coaching staffs, was sparked by the Spurs coaching staff getting into the referee's ear. And obviously we can't hear what's going on down there, so maybe he very much had a point. But I think the point that Dan raises about the energy he brought to the game is the key point here, in terms of losing a bit of respect for him in a way, because we obviously love his style of play. It was clear to see how great it was. But it wasn't like he got wound up throughout the match through all these decisions which went against them. And he rightly could have done, because some of them were absolutely shocking. But it's the fact that he came into the game, you know, trying to stir things up right from the off. And when he says, he's talking about it afterwards, I mean, we tried to press him on it in the press conference, you know, both trying to get to the bottom of what had got him so angry, but also the fact that this isn't the first time he's been sent off this season. In fact, he's now got two. If he gets touchline banned, which he probably will, then that would be his third of the season after two red cards and four yellow cards. If you get four yellow cards, then you automatically get a touchline ban in the Premier League, and four yellow cards. I mean, that just sort of speaks to this disciplinary issue that he seems to have. And when we asked about that, I think it was Dan Matthews of the Mail asked about, you know, are you worried about your disciplinary record? And he sort of kind of admitted maybe, but that's his passion. He's going to struggle to change. And on the one hand, I get that. I like to see that fiery passion. It seems to go overboard, and it went overboard before the game had even begun. So I don't really give him much of a pass for that. But yeah, poor Christian Cellini. At this point, I think we're still waiting to find out what the outcome of that will be, because basically the rule is that they get sent off, they basically take responsibility for their coaching staff, but it doesn't necessarily mean they will get a touchline ban. Later on, the FA then look into it and work out whether they want to punish the individuals from the coaching staff that were responsible for the bust up or the managers themselves. But overall, great football. But yeah, I don't know. I do wonder if he may have not talked himself out of a job at Tottenham, but it might not have gone down particularly well.
No, and I think what was also significant, the fact that Cellini went, meant that Ryan Mason then took charge. Spurs made some substitutions. The letter-spotted Dan Juma appeared. And that could be significant, because I thought he made a little bit of an impression in the few minutes he was on the pitch. Now, decisions on the Tottenham squad are expected to fall under the remit of the club's new chief football officer, Scott Munn, who was appointed a few days ago. Dan, what do we know about him?
We don't know a huge amount, Marcus. He seems to be a kind of fairly private bloke, almost in the Levy mould, in that he hasn't done many interviews or he hasn't been particularly public-facing in his previous jobs. But he's worked for the City Football Group. He's their chief executive. That's the group that owns Manchester City, of course. He's been their chief exec in China for the last few years. And before that, he was with Melbourne City, previously Melbourne Heart, but they were rebranded when they became a kind of part of that multi-club network with City. We know that he has great experience in sporting administrative roles. He worked on the 2000 Sydney Olympics bid. He's worked for the NRL and AFL in Australia before moving into football in about 2009, I think. So he's got about 14 years or so in football. So, yeah, he's clearly someone that is experienced in sporting administration. That's Daniel Levy's weakness, I think it's fair to say. You know, he's a businessman. He doesn't, he hasn't been particularly good at running the football side of the club. But I think probably it's fair to be a little bit underwhelmed by his CV, given that he hasn't worked in Europe before. You know, this will be his first job in European football. It's not like Paratici, you know, when he came in, and Levy could point to the fact that he had been running one of the biggest clubs in Europe for a long time. You know, Scott Munn has not been doing that, but he's been working for City Group, who obviously are hugely ambitious, hugely wealthy, and have shown themselves to be very, very adept at running football clubs on the sporting side of things, as well as obviously the business side of things, albeit they've got a massive advantage in that they're owned by a state. So, yeah, for me, if his appointment is the start of something, then I think it's rather than the end, rather than the kind of end point, then I think it's very encouraging. You know, if he's being brought in and with a remit and the space and power to build the kind of structure that we talked about last week that Brighton have, to revamp the medical department, to revamp the analysis department, the scouting department, and build Spurs into a club with a modern vision and structure, then that's exciting. If he's being brought in as another buffer between Daniel Levy and football decisions, if he's going to be essentially another yes man for Levy and someone who isn't given the space and power, doesn't have the powers delegated to him from above, then it's ultimately meaningless, I guess. I mean, and we just don't know. You know, time will tell. But if he's being brought in to really change things and give Spurs the kind of modern structure that they clearly need to compete with the likes of City, then I think it's a step in the right direction.
I mean, Tom, obviously it's not an appointment that's going to get the crowd chattering with excitement, but what do you read into his appointment?
Well, I think a key point is that he will be above Fabio Paratici or whoever, or if he were to hypothetically leave the club, he would be above the director of football. And that is quite key. I mean, he's just going to be involved in all football matters and all the things that we're going to go on to talk about next on, you know, squad. It's not like he has the final say, as I understand it, on transfers, on new contracts, on other appointments, but he will be heavily influential. He does seem like he is cut from a similar cloth to Daniel Levy, as Dan pointed out. I don't think he's going to be the most, I don't know if it's going to be that likely we'll get to speak to him too often. I'm heading out to Perth for the pre-season tour, and I guess we're putting slightly two and two together because he's Australian. We don't actually know if he's even going to be there, but if he were to be there, you know, we're hoping for an interview, and I think maybe that could be a possibility, but I also wouldn't count on it because I don't think from what I've read and what it sounds like, he's the kind of person who will be doing regular interviews like maybe a Paul Barber at Brighton. But it's interesting what Dan was saying about, you know, Man City, obviously a state backed, so he's had a lot of money to play with from the City Group, but also I think he's shown before that, particularly with, I think it was Melbourne City or maybe Melbourne Heart when it was called that, they were a club that didn't have a lot of money at all. And in fact, City Group helped them out massively with that. And he's got the background of building clubs with a very precise and financially savvy way. And when you think of where Tottenham are in the hierarchy of the Premier League in terms of spending money, obviously they've got a lot of money to spend, but they're not state backed. That kind of fiscal shrewdness would be a good addition to this club.
Just a quick point. I do wonder whether his appointment suggests Levy and Enoch might be thinking about the multi-club model as well. Obviously, we know that Chelsea are looking into that. City are doing it. It does seem to be the future for super clubs in the game, and obviously Scott Mum will have a lot of experience of that, given he's worked for Melbourne City and City's club in China, whose name escapes me. So something to keep an eye on there.
Well, just on one point on that, one of the quotes that I think Ali Gold at Football London went through all the things he'd said. I mean, there actually weren't that many, but one was quite interesting about China, because obviously he's been working in China, and I think it was something like, you know, if you're in football, you have to get into China because of the massive fan base. Obviously, there's a lot of money to be made. So that would be interesting. He's obviously got a lot of expertise on that front from a global point of view. And then you just look at not only, you know, Man City with their sort of 9-10 clubs around the world, but look at Brighton. Tony Bloom also owns Union Saint-Gilloise, if that's how you pronounce it, who are going to be playing in the Europa League quarterfinals on Thursday evening. I think the second in the league. It's where Caro Mitoma was sent on loan, who's now an absolute superstar and definitely should have had a goal against Tottenham at the weekend. So I think just, you know, that is one example of how that can really benefit, particularly when benefit a club generally, but also particularly a club like Spurs who have you know, endless reams of cash. A bit like Brighton, I'm obviously at next level, but the way Brighton are building is obviously a very clever model, and I think that would be quite a sensible thing to do in the modern age.
Union Saint-Gilloise, to give it its absolutely correct pronunciation, and I only know that, Tom, because having done a lot of Europa League highlights this season, I have been bollocked several times by the producer for not getting that right, and it's finally been imprinted in my mind. Union Saint-Gilloise, they had a very good run in Europe as well. So Mun's going to be having a close look at the squad, which is what we're going to do now. An overall assessment. Does it require major surgery, minor tweaks? What's the biggest priority come the summer in terms of ins and outs? What kind of manager does the squad suit? And which of any of the on-loan players, this is really interesting, potentially have a future at Spurs, because there are a lot of players out on loan, some of them very good, some of them doing pretty well. So many issues. Then I guess we should just go through it in terms of the positions, and we can talk about the priorities when we come to them. And the goalkeeping situation has to be one of those. Lloris and Forster,
the two men with the gloves at the moment. And I thought Forster did a really good job, to be fair, when Lloris was out injured recently. But what's going to happen with the goalkeepers, Mr. Kilpatrick?
Well, they're both out of contract to the end of next season. And it's pretty tricky to see either of them being number one for the start of next season as it stands. You know, Lloris has now done, you know, over a decade at Spurs as number one, but it just feels like he's entering a new chapter of his career. You know, he's obviously relinquished the France captaincy, or rather retired from the national team. And I do wonder whether he could be off in the summer, because Spurs obviously need a new number one, a new long-term successor for him. I think that will be a priority for the squad. And it's pretty hard to see Lloris sticking around as a kind of number two, albeit he's, you know, very influential in the dressing room. But I just think he'll, at this stage of his career, he's not the type to be a backup. He'll probably want to keep playing. So I could see Lloris moving on. I could see Spurs going for a new number one goalkeeper. And I think Forster, as you said, has proved himself to be a very able deputy. So he will probably stay on and see out his contract for another year. I can imagine Lloris possibly going back to France, maybe MLS, something like that. So that'll be a really interesting one to see, because he's been part of the furniture of Spurs for so long. I think that, you know, most new managers coming in are going to want a goalkeeper who is slightly better with his feet as well. And I think that's another factor. So I would expect that to be an area where Spurs look to change.
Yeah, just on that, I think Forster's performances have given whoever's the manager something to think about. I think he performed really, really well. And the fact that he could be relied upon could make a difference. But ultimately, I think it comes down to what Dan was saying there about the ability to either of them to play with their feet with the modern day game. I just think that's such a key aspect. I was watching Man City last night, and wow, I mean, we all know about Edison, but the way he, as where his kicks now getting longer, he absolutely smashes them the whole way down. I mean, it was particularly windy at the Etihad last night, but obviously it's not just that. It's the way, you know, the comfort when he's in possession, you know, when the ball is laid back to them, and the fact that they are getting on a little bit. So personally, I'd be really surprised if Tottenham didn't go for a new keeper. And, you know, we went through the options before. David Raya, obviously, we really stood out, but Jordan Pickford's a name that keeps coming back. So definitely think that one will be where one of the areas they'll be looking to strengthen.
Yeah, okay, so that's a priority. I have to say, we all love Hugo Lloris, but I panic now every time he is trying to pass out from the back. Oh, dear, get your kittens. Talking of kittens, our defence. Now, Christian Romero, we know how wonderful he is. We also know that he can't coach for 90 minutes without picking up a yellow card, so you need plenty of able deputies as far as he's concerned. And then the list of, dubious characters is not fair, but Davinson Sanchez, Japhet Tanganga, Eric Dier, whose contract is up in the summer of 2024. That's the same situation as Harry Kane. Clement Longley, who is on loan from Barcelona. I keep reading different stories. Yes, they're going to sign him. No, they're not going to sign him. Should they? Davis, who's been a wonderful servant at the club. Sessegnon, who for me, just, it's not happening. Porro, who's come in and is starting to make an impression, I think, and Emerson Royal. And if I'd said this a few weeks ago, I'd have been taken away by men in white coats. But how we are missing him, how we've missed him over the past couple of weeks since he got injured. So where do you start with our tale of woe at the back, Tom?
I think the first thing, which is key, you know, back to the goalkeepers or any of these positions, is we need to work out who the next manager is going to be, because the way they play is obviously going to be so key to this whole team. You know, say it's if it were to be a Luis Enrique, hypothetically, he obviously plays really, really possession-based football. So that's going to be make a big difference into which kind of centre-back they go after. Are they going to play four at the back? Can they play four at the back with this team? So to start off with Romero, I mean, obviously, I'd be stunned if Tottenham were looking to move him on, because he's on his day. He's not only a World Cup winning defender, but I think a world-class defender as well, but also a strange one that he can be a liability, as you referenced with his rash tackles. And I'd be intrigued to know how well he would fare in a back four. I know we saw it for Argentina, but the sort of hurly by the belly of the Premier League might be a different matter. I really feel like generally, but Tottenham really need a good organizer at the back, which is what, when Eric Dier is on his game, he is that. But as we know, he's been a bit inconsistent for quite a while now. And I don't think Romero is that kind of player. But I guess to start off with, you know, he's obviously staying. Sanchez, I believe, has a year on his contract left after this one, if I'm right. He's obviously been pretty much frozen out this season. It's quite rare he's come on. I remember being in Seoul in pre-season, and he was flying into tackles there, and talk about a liability. He looked a liability even against the, you know, Korean All-Stars team. And I don't really think much has changed on that front when he has played this season. Again, on his day, he is a solid defender, but I think he will generally go down as an overpriced signing that didn't really work out. The fact that he might, you know, if they do keep him, might move on for a free transfer speaks to that. But I would expect him to leave in the summer. And then just to finish off the centre-backs, and Dan can move on to the full-backs. Eric Dier is an interesting situation. I'm keep trying to find out what's the latest on that. I'm still trying to get to the bottom of that. But as you say, his contract's up in his time. So far, I've not heard of any new contract talks happening, but I could be wrong on that. Jafet Tanganga obviously has been lacking of game time. He's had injury issues, obviously, in the past, which I think can continue to hold him back. I don't think when he's come in this season... I think he came in for the Brentford game just after the World Cup, if I'm right. And I know Tony rips players to shreds all season long, but I feel like he really, you know, got into Tanganga that team on that day. And I don't feel like he really, you know, did his case, you know, much good in that game. The one thing on his side is the fact that he's homegrown. And obviously with the quota for Tottenham ever shrinking, really, they don't have loads of players they've brought through the club into the first team. Obviously Kane, Skip, and then you're looking at players like Harvey White who've gone out on loan. So that might be one part of it, but I wouldn't be surprised at the same time to see him move on. And then Longley, I don't know, I wonder what people think of Longley. I mean, overall, I think he's been okay. I don't think they sort of deferred this whole big money centre-back signing for a year with his loan. And Conte seemed to be generally pretty happy with that. Obviously, there was a lot of talk about players like Bastoni. They couldn't get other big money centre-backs in the summer. And eventually they went for Longley. And I think Conte really rated him. He did play him quite a lot. And there have been games where he's looked a France international. But then other games, he's looked a player that there's a reason why he's not playing for France as much anymore. And I feel like, I do wonder, you know, having had this one, even if some people might be writing him off, the amount of foreign players who come in aren't brilliant in the first season and they kick on next year. I wonder if he were re-signed, whether it be on loan or a permanent fee, whether we might expect a lot, we could expect to see a lot more from him next season. But having said that, I don't think, you know, he'd be a signing that would really wow the fans either.
Yeah, I think defence for me is the one area of the squad which you look at and think it's really been quantified, if I can use that phrase. So many of those players, maybe the majority, are just set up to play in a back three. I think, as Tom said, we're not really sure if Romero would be comfortable in the two in the Premier League, although I think he would, after taking some time to get used to it. Dier has never convinced in a back two and feels like a centre-back who's a kind of back three specialist now. Davis does not feel like he's ever been good enough as a left-back, but does well on the left side of the back three. And Sessegnon, Porro, obviously Perisic, all feel like wing-backs over full-backs. Emerson's perhaps the one defender who has felt like he's not benefited from the system, really, because he feels more like a right back than a right wing back. So that a lot will depend, I think, on who the new manager is. And if it was a manager off the top of my head like Ruben Amorim, who has typically played a back three, then perhaps there would be a future for you know, some of those defenders. But if it was a Pochettino or someone we know would prefer to play a four-man defence, then I think this is the one area, above all others, where Spurs really need to refresh the squad. And it does feel like there's a lot of kind of relics of the Pochettino era in that group who really should have been moved on earlier. I mean, for instance, I really like Ben Davis. I think he's a great guy and someone who a lot of managers, including Conte, who was very complimentary about him toward the end, which was something given the way he spoke about the squad as a whole. You know, even Ben Davis, you know, he's been at Spurs for nearly a decade, often been content to be a backup, which I think you could say is a bit of a problem. But he's someone who probably I kind of like to see moved on, really, just because he feels like a kind of relic of a former era. I think Spurs need to be buying players who, you know, are hungrier, have something to prove, and can kind of add some sort of freshness to a squad that still does feel a bit stale. So I think, yeah, in terms of defence, Tom covered a lot of it off. I think a lot will depend on the new manager, but certainly it's an area where it's gone a bit stale. There hasn't been enough improvement there. There haven't been enough signings to improve the best 11. So I think a lot of work is needed this summer.
Yeah, and Tom mentioned Bastoni, who I watched race forward on Tuesday night to deliver a wonderful cross for Inter's first goal at Benfica. I'd love to get some quality like that at the back, someone who can defend and also break forward with great effect. Now, the midfield, clearly Bentancur has been hugely missed following his injury. Oliver Skipp's come back in after his injury, and I thought he had another really good game against Brighton last weekend. Basuma's the forgotten man. He's been injured, of course. Saar is waiting to become a star. Højbjerg seems to really divide opinions. I mean, some people love him. Others think, no, he's just a little bit too basic. So what do we think as far as the midfield is concerned?
I think there's a lot of quality there. A lot of different type of players that any new manager could really get to work with. I think there's a lot of untapped potential in the likes of Bissouma, who will, you know, hopefully, I don't know where we're at with his recovery at the moment. Looks like, I'm not sure. When he got injured, Conte wasn't sure whether he would make the end of the season. He might do, but we've got to hope that he'll be fit for pre-season and hopefully for next season. And I really feel, I know I've banged on about it loads because I've watched him so much for Brighton in the flesh over the last 4 years or so, and I know what a good player he can be, and he really has never, he's not close to hitting those heights at Spurs. So he's someone that probably, you know, Spurs fans in their frustration have probably almost given up on, because that's what we do when we see a player have a poor season. You think, well, I can't rely on them, and it's understandable because over a course of a long enough sample of time, they haven't done well enough. But he's still young, and he's still got so much talent that if a manager gets the best out of him, he could suddenly become a really show what a top player is and why he was ready to go to the next level. Bentancur is an absolutely fabulous player who is one of the few examples of a player that Conte improved. I think he really fit that system. I do wonder about Højbjerg. I think Højbjerg, I've been one of his biggest defenders, and I think in Conte's system, he really, really suits it, but he does play safe a lot of the time. And in a two in midfield, maybe sometimes that can get frustrating. Albeit he has popped up with a few goals and a few assists, but the amount of times he'll get the ball, look to control it, slow things down and pass sort of sideways to get a move going again, which I think someone like Conte and a lot of people, maybe rightly so, would see as, right, everyone relax and let's start again. But for others, it might be a bit slow and maybe even ponderous at times, as opposed to Bentancur, who I think he's just technically a better player. He doesn't really have to watch the ball into his foot. He picks it up and he moves and he's making things happen. So I really do, you know, back to what we were saying about whoever the new manager is going to be, you do wonder, you know, how Højbjerg is going to fit in it. If it's someone in a similar vein to Conte, or someone who isn't really, really obsessed with possession-based football, you know, he definitely could have a big part to play. But if it is someone who does, you know, fancies his more sort of technically gifted midfielders, then I wonder about that.
Just on Højbjerg, I think he has a role to play, but as a squad player, really. I think the frustration with Højbjerg is since he's signed, and I don't have the stats for this, but I expect he's played more than anyone else, with the possible exception of Harry Kane. I mean, he's just been such a mainstay. And in a way, he's almost been the kind of symbol of this bleak Mourinho, Nuno, Conte era, really, because he's just played so much and been relied on by all those managers. So I do think he has a role to play, but I think it would be more of a squad role than a first name on the team sheet type role, which he's obviously been doing. Yeah, I mean, I largely agree with Tom's assessment. I think there's a solid base there. I mean, a lot depends on how Bentancur recovers from injury. I mean, I've been kind of watching Van Dijk in the last few weeks and Joe Gomez as well, who, you know, did a similar injury and just haven't quite looked the same for Liverpool, and that's a concern, obviously. But Bentancur, I thought, was great and arguably his first player of the season before he was injured. So fingers crossed he comes back. Bissouma, I agree. You know, a lot of potential there. Conte never got the best out of him, but he was great at Brighton, and you'd expect that he could be one of the players to really kick on under a new manager. And then, yeah, I like Skip and Sarr. I mean, I think what I would like to see is a new kind of creative-minded midfielder brought in, and Sarr probably the guy to go out on loan, spend a year in the Premier League. I think he's shown with his performance in the San Siro and in the league as well that he can do a job and could do a job for a kind of lower mid-table side. So I think that would be a great move for him. And Skip, I think, is promising. You know, I still think I need to see more of him, really, because he's just not played enough and didn't play enough in the first half of the season particularly. But he can use both feet. He can move the ball well. He can run with it. He breaks up play nicely. And again, I think he's a really useful squad player. So I think there's a decent base there in the midfield to build on. But clearly, it needs more creativity. And that was what a lot of people were kind of frustrated about throughout the Conte era, really, that there seemed to be kind of next to no interest in trying to bring in an Eriksen. And Conte was always relying on these substandard wingbacks and his kind of wide forwards to provide the spark. But I never saw why that he couldn't have found someone to add a bit more flair in the middle of the park, which I think the current crop aren't really capable of doing.
Just on Skip, I do quite like the way when he's playing well, he has that sort of positive style. He gets the ball and he moves forward. It kind of counter to what we were saying about Højbjerg, and a bit more, it's more similar to Bentancur. And that's one of the things I really like about him. And obviously he's also a homegrown player, which obviously plays into his hands. Just very briefly on Højbjerg, you know, saying about how maybe he have a role to play, more of a squad player. I wonder if he would be really up for that. I don't know if he would. I think he likes playing regularly. It wasn't that long ago that Real Madrid was even being talked about, and I'm pretty sure Carlo Ancelotti likes him as a player. So I don't, depends, you know, how much you read into that. But I think he's a player who, yeah. Believe it or not, yeah.
Good luck to him. I mean, if he can get a move to Madrid, then
I'm not saying now. This is when, I think this was about a year ago or so, when they were thinking about a new midfielder. I do think he is appreciated by a lot of managers around Europe, and I don't know if he would want to settle for a squad role. And I wonder if it's the same for Emerson now. I'm pretty sure he had the opportunity to leave in January, back to Europe to some decent clubs, and he wanted to stay. I wonder if that'll still be the case in the summer. He's obviously had a great second half of the season before he got injured. People seem to be realizing what he can do. But Porro signing, you spend that much money on a player, and we can already see what a great attacking player he is. I don't know. We'll see. And then obviously it comes on, you know, we've got Jed Spence coming back. Whether a new manager will fancy him, that all comes into it. So it might not be just the case that these players are you know, happy to be squad players.
Yeah, I mean, Spurs need two players in every position. It's more with Højbjerg that I don't think he should be a first name on the team sheet anymore. You know, he should be fighting for his place in there. There are four midfielders at the moment, and I'm including Sarr in that, who I think are all of fairly similar standard. And it shouldn't be the case, I think, going forward, that the Højbjerg is kind of playing as many minutes as Kane and Lloris and Son, which he has been. I just also wanted to mention Perisic, because we didn't really cover him in the defenders, and I've actually written him on my list as a midfielder. I think he's a player who kind of was synonymous with Conte, very much bought for Conte's system, bought for Conte, having played with him at Inter Milan, has been underwhelming, hasn't looked particularly well suited to the Premier League at this stage in his career. And so I think he is definitely a player who Spurs should and probably will look to move on in the summer.
We'll touch upon the loanees in just a moment. As far as the strikers are concerned, well, obviously the biggest question of all is the future of Harry Kane. There are those who suggest that Son, despite scoring his 100th Premier League goal at the weekend, might benefit from a move. The club might benefit from selling him. And then there's the question of Dan Juma. Do we buy him? So briefly, I mean, those are three vital questions. Tom, what are the answers to them?
Well, $100 million question for Harry Kane. I still get the sense that they won't sell him in the summer. They're more likely to let him go for on a free, but other people disagree, you know, whether that's sort of, you know, positioning. I don't know, but Harry Kane is, as we've discussed many times, is a really unique situation. He's so synonymous with the club. His sale or his letting go on a free transfer would mean so would have such massive implications on the fan base and the way the ownership is viewed. I think maybe a better and sort of new way of talking about it is to bring in Son. And I'd be really surprised if two of them left at the same time in the same summer, because Son has shown that he can play through the middle. I know he's had a poor season, but overall, you know, as I said, after he scored that absolutely brilliant goal at the weekend for his 100th Premier League goal, despite a difficult season, he's still a Premier League legend from a Tottenham point of view, and maybe a Premier League legend overall. And he can play through the middle. So if they were somehow to lose Kane this summer, I really couldn't see Son going. And in a way, I think because Son's been so good for so long, we do sort of maybe wonder if age is catching up with him. But he's still only 30. He keeps himself really fit. I think I wouldn't be surprised if he was maybe not back to hitting the heights of winning the Golden Boot next season, but a fresh start under a new manager, a new way of doing things, maybe one that tries to improve players, but always a bit better at improving players, even players at that age. We could see him maybe not back to his best, but back to a really, really top Premier League player.
Yeah, I think assuming Kane stays, Spurs are going to need another forward over the summer because Lucas is going to leave on a free. And it looks unlikely, I suppose, at this stage that Danjuma would sign permanently. I just don't think anyone's seen enough of him to be able to make an informed decision on that. I mean, that may change in the run-in, although I'd be pretty surprised. So the real question is what type of forward they bring in over anything else, I think. Obviously, Kulusevski is going to sign permanently, whatever happens. Richarlison, I think, will want to prove a lot of people wrong next season, as will Son. And we won't go into detail on Kane now, but I think I agree with Tom. You know, I find it hard to imagine Spurs selling him in the summer. So, yeah, I'd like to see Spurs go out and you know, sign a forward who could improve the first 11. I think that's what Spurs should always be looking to do. You know, sign a player who's not just going to be a kind of backup for Kane and Son and Kulusevski, but really push them for a place. I think that should be the priority in terms of the forward line.
Just briefly on that, Marcus, I just feel like if you were Daniel Levy and you were looking back to sort of saying about Bissouma, you'd still be wanting to a bit of on your return, really, for someone like Richarlison. He's had just a poor season, but you can't just dismiss him. He's only 1 year into his, you know, a long contract. And suddenly, like we hoped last summer when they brought in these players, you thought, wow, there's real strength and depth here. If you get Son back to where he was playing, if Kane stays and Richarlison starts to kick on under a new manager, then suddenly it doesn't really feel like it needs that much extra additions. But although Dan does point out, obviously, Moura's leaving and Dan Juma, it seems at this point difficult to see them signing him permanently.
So in summation, we reckon a new goalkeeper is essential. Perhaps another defender who'd be comfortable in a back four. Creative midfield player, James Maddison is the name that everybody is mentioning at the moment. A striker, another good striker up front. Of course, that's something that every club wants. And just in terms of the big name players who are out on loan at the moment, Lo Celso and Ndombele, Gil, Reguilon, Winks, Spence and Rodon, which of those, if any, have a future at Tottenham?
That is a difficult question when you look at it. I don't know if there are that many of them at all that really have much of a future. Mainly when you think of the four players that were put into a bit of a bomb squad last season or last pre-season, Winks, Reguilon, Ndombele and Lo Celso, Tottenham wanted to sell all four of those players and there were no takers, hence why they sent them on loan. And also many of them without an option. and shows how desperate they were to let them go. Harry Winks briefly at Sampdoria. Sampdoria have got major financial troubles at the moment, and they're probably going to get relegated. So be absolutely astounded if they could even try and sign Harry Winks. So I think he'll be looking for a new club. Some people have sort of talked about, you know, if Pochettino were to come back, given what he thinks of Harry Winks, would there be an opportunity? But I understand that he's probably going to be looking for a new club in the summer. And Ndombele, you know, he's playing for a team that's going to win the Serie A and have a chance of winning the Champions League. But has he played that much of a role in it? Not really. And I don't know whether Napoli will be looking to sign him permanently. He's been quite expensive, so I'm not sure about that. Lo Celso is one that, to be honest, I haven't followed that closely how he's been getting on Villarreal this season. Last year, he was very good and they didn't sign him then. Although, again, that I think that was due to finances. But you'd look at him and think he would probably move on. So I can't see too many. Maybe Brian Hill.
Dan, yeah. Is there anyone you're yearning to see back in a Spurs shirt? Every night you lie in bed thinking, yeah, I want Ndombele back doing nothing in midfield.
I'm not going to get onto Ndombele. I've kind of learnt my lesson on that one. Sadly, I don't think it's going to work. I mean, the only player out on loan I think definitely has a future at Spurs is Spence. I think his lack of minutes last season was very much a Conte issue, really, rather than a Spence issue. It just seemed to be Conte making a point and being stubborn rather than Spence not being good enough. Possibly Hill. I mean, he just seems happier and better suited to Spain. But you never know. A new manager could like the look of him. I think he is a promising young player. I mean, Reguilón, I find it strange that Spurs sent him out alone. I think he could have done a job at wing-back this season. But I don't see him having a future. Likewise, I think Winks needs a fresh start and has looked pretty good in Italy. And Ndombele and Lo Celso haven't played nearly as much as they should have. And I think Spurs will find it hard to move them on, but will want to. Rodon, similarly, hasn't made enough of an impression in France and I think hasn't really looked like he's up to the required standard. Udogie and Spence are two kind of exciting young players to come back and improve that defence, either in a back three or four.
Just briefly on Spence, one thing I've been looking around, sort of, you know, looking to possible transfers for Tottenham, speaking to agents. One thing that's come back, which is quite interesting, just about the Jed Spence situation. Tottenham have got a history of signing good young English British players. I think the Spence's situation is making a few young players think a bit about Spurs now because they don't want to be in the same situation as what he has been signing for, you know, making that big move to Tottenham and not getting an opportunity at all. Now, obviously, I'm sure Spurs would argue that was specifically Conte. He's gone now. Things may change and they may go back to, you know, being one of those great clubs that sort of develops young English talent, which we saw under Pochettino. But it's just an interesting point that may affect where some of the best young players ultimately look to go in the summer.
And of course, where Spurs finish will probably have an effect on who might wish to join, who might wish to leave. 8 games left, just briefly. I know that Dan officially does not do predictions, so I wouldn't dare ask him how he thinks they're going against Bournemouth at home, Newcastle away, then this key run, Newcastle away, Manchester United at home, then Liverpool away. That's obviously the three matches that are going to go a very long way towards deciding where Spurs finish. And then it's Palace at home, Aston Villa away, and Villa up to 6th, one of E-form teams at the moment. Brentford at home, that could be a tough one. And then Leeds, who might be fighting for survival on the final day of the season. 8 games. I've perhaps generously guesstimated that Spurs will pick up 14 points from those matches. And bearing in mind, we're already 3 behind Manchester United and Newcastle, who've played a game less. Well, when we play those sides, they're essential. But if you were betting men at this point, would you say that Spurs will finish in the top 4?
I'll do a prediction, Marcus. And
wow, we're honoured.
Well, I wouldn't bet on it, no. I mean, you look at the fixtures now, and I think with the exception of Bournemouth, Palace and Leeds, there's 5 games against teams in the top 9. So it's not an easy run-in. As you said, I'm glad you mentioned Villa because I was going to mention them. Absolutely flying. They've been transformed by Emery and actually could, you know, even be contenders for perhaps not fourth, but certainly fifth or sixth place now. They look really, really good, and they've got momentum at the right time. It's going to be determined, I think, assuming the Bournemouth game goes to plan, that run coming up against Newcastle, United, and Liverpool feels like it's going to determine whether Spurs are really in the mix for fourth place. I mean, if they play like they did against Brighton, then I can't see it. They're going to have to be much well, better.
We'll be all right, Dan, as long as VAR's on our side again. We could beat anybody with that team.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose, I mean, a genuine interesting question, I think, is kind of whether, and we've said this so many times before, but whether we might see Son back to something like the last season's levels. I mean, he was quite interesting after the Brighton game and sort of said, he hinted that his position was a factor in an improved performance. And there has been some suggestion that, you know, he was playing way too deep and with his back to goal under Conte. Perhaps one minor tweak Stellini will make is just kind of get Son on the last man again, free him up a little bit. And I think Saturday's game against Brighton was a kind of reminder of so many Spurs games of the last sort of 3.5 years where they haven't played well, but they've just been bailed out by having two world-class forwards. And if Kane and Son are firing in the run-in, then who knows what could happen. But, you know, as it stands, I definitely wouldn't bet on Spurs coming fourth, not least because Newcastle have found some form again. And it's a tricky, tricky run-in from here.
Tom, yes or no for a top four finish?
No, I don't think so. And I'm worrying about top six now because the competition's so fierce. I mean, I have looked, Newcastle's run-in's quite tough as well. They're playing really well, but a lot of their games are difficult. As Dan said, though, those three games, how they get on at Newcastle, Man United and Liverpool will be key. You've got to hope that Palace by then are on the beach with because Roy's turned around very quickly, but maybe by then they'll be safe. Same maybe for Villa if they start to plateau. But it feels like they've almost just come a bit too late, really, because they're going so well that otherwise they would be in the mix for top four. Leeds away the final day of the season could be really, really tough. And we know how Brentford can be as well. So I just feel like the two in the box seat at the moment are playing better, have got the advantage points-wise, games-wise, and I feel like it's too much to make up for them now. And I don't really feel like Tottenham have played well enough all season really to deserve it. And they were very lucky against Brighton. And I just feel like those drop points at Southampton and Everton, perhaps that was one of the reasons why Conte was so frustrated at Southampton, because he knew what the run-in was looking like coming up and how that really could play a huge part in it. And I feel like that might do for them.
Well, that is a rather a deflating way for us to end this latest edition of the Tottenham podcast. It has been known for Tom and Dan to occasionally get things wrong. Let's hope that this is one of those, although I have to concur, it's going to take something pretty special and a massively improved set of performances compared to last weekend if Spurs are to have a chance. Dan Kilpatrick of the Evening Standard, Tom Barkley of The Sun, thank you very much indeed. I'm Marcus Buckman. Thank you for listening. As always, if you're going to the game on Saturday, enjoy it. Get behind the team as much as you possibly can, which is what I try to do. And then I suddenly find myself screaming at Eric Dyer or somebody else. And there was a young lad sitting in front of me last weekend for the Brighton game. I fear it was his first ever match. And he looked at me as though I was some sort of ghoul from hell. And I realized, come on, control yourself, behave. But we know what Spurs do to us. Give us a review on iTunes or Apple Podcasts. We're on Twitter and Instagram at The Tottenham Way. You can follow us all on Twitter too. Thank you very much. Come on, you Spurs.